Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to episode 24 of the DesignFootball.com podcast. My name is Jay. I'm a resident blogger on DesignFootball.com. Today I'm joined by Sean Pankhurst, who is a freelance sportswear designer and is formerly of Nike and Canterbury. Hi Sean, welcome to the podcast.
Hi Jay, how are you?
Yeah, not so bad. And yourself?
I'm good, thanks. Good.
Okay, now to start off with, just tell us a little bit about how you got into sportswear design. What was it that was of interest, or was it of interest at all when you were a kid, for example?
Well, funnily enough, I wanted to be a football kit designer since I was about seven. My dad used to be was a sort of ex-pro footballer and sort of got me into football. But most of the time, I was more interested in the kits than actually what I was supposed to be doing on the football pitch.
Okay. So what did that take any particular form when you were a kid? Was this something you'd be drawing pictures of kits in your spare time, that kind of thing?
So it all started with, I was a Chelsea fan at the time. And it was about the time when replica kits became really quite big. I obviously, as any young lad wanted a football kit myself, and I couldn't afford one. So I took it upon myself to start drawing them as a kind of fantasy thing. At the time as well, there was a lot of these sort of mini kits around, I started to copy those, and that led on to actually designing kits myself. The first kits that I ever did were for the 94 World Cup. Mm-hmm. And that was for I sort of mocked up a catalogue myself, and basically designed a kit for every team that was in the 1994 World Cup in the USA.
Excellent. So have you still got those?
I have. Believe it or not, I didn't realise, but my mum, a few years ago, took me up into the attic and showed me all these catalogues that I'd done. And it wasn't just for USI 94, it was for pretty much every major tournament and every Premier League season that was from 1994 till about, 2000 or something like that. It was quite a few years and quite a few catalogues.
So was this like a yearly tradition then? Before the new kits came out, you'd design a whole load, or would this be after the kits had come out for that season, or would you preempt them?
I'd preempt them. I'd spend basically the 6 weeks of my summer holiday going through designing football kits. I was brought up on a farm, so there wasn't a lot to do. It wasn't as if I could go out and call for my mates every evening. So most of the time, I would either be outside in the field with a five-a-side goal that my dad had built me, or I'd be indoors drawing football kits. So football kits were my life.
Yeah, I had similar things when I was a kid. Not to that extent. That's true dedication. But I remember in my early 20s or mid 20s, I think, I had folders of these things, and I decided I was too old to keep them, and I remember throwing them all in a bin. And if I could go back in time and just fish them out now, I would. All gone. But I'm happy that you've managed to keep hold of those, or to your surprise, they still exist, put it that way.
Well, this is it. I've got my mum to thank for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this does bode pretty well for the future. But as you obviously getting older, you're getting towards leaving school and so on, what your decisions are starting to be made, was this a factor in your decision making at that point of what you're going to do for the rest of your life?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I was relentless. I was absolutely relentless. At that point, this is why I can pinpoint the age that I actually decided that I wanted to do it, because when I first spoke to my careers advisor when I was sort of 13, she asked me sort of, kind of what area I wanted to go in, whether that was, art, whether that was business or whatever it may be. And I said I wanted to be a football kit designer. And that is what I was going to do. obviously she laughed at me and said, well, the best way to set foot on that road is to go to art college. I was to do BTEC National Diploma. And my first interview at the college to actually get in to do that course, rather than present to them all my, course study work, that's what I should have presented. But unfortunately, I went to the interview with all these catalogues of football kits that I'd done since I was seven. And I later heard that the reason why I got in on that course was not, the work that I should have done, but it was purely because they could see the passion that was in uh-huh. and the fire that was in my eyes.
That's fantastic. That's you wouldn't expect that. I mean, so was this kind of a 100% record then? This was the only place you'd applied to and you got in on that basis?
Yeah.
That's perfect then. That sounds great. You would expect that maybe there would be people who play it by the book and say, well, no, this isn't of the level we require. This isn't formatted in the way we require. So we can't offer you a place. But then someone would see that passion and say, okay, I'm willing to take a chance on you. But for the only people you went to actually see it, I suppose it was meant to be. So where did you go from there then? Was this entire course, were you able to draw pictures of kits this entire course? I'm guessing not.
Well, the same tutor that let me into the course then spent the next 2 years trying to beat out of me football kit design and how I approached art and design.
Yeah.
It was quite a feat, but I think on the last few months that I was there, when I was due to do my final collection, he managed to achieve it and got me looking at fashion from a slightly different point of view than bold prints and colours, which was generally how I approached design even at that point. Obviously I was a kid who grew up in the 90s.
Yeah.
It was all about geometric prints, bold, bright colours, and all that kind of thing that came from football kit design. And essentially, it therefore meant that everything I did within design from that point onwards would always be from that point of view. But as I say, thankfully, he managed to get that out of me towards the end.
Yeah, so he managed to get it out of you, but it is something you return to. So what was the next stage then after that?
So the next stage was to go on to HND, university. I spent 2 years doing that and then moved on to the final year of a degree. But again, I sort of took that sort of the stuff that I'd learned at college and, I've tried to kind of expand my focus out a little bit. And I started to become more interested in fashion and more interested in lifestyle. I never wanted to be a couture designer or anything like that, but I started to wonder whether I could actually, cut it as a designer of general fashion or clothing or something like that, rather than being so tunnel visioned on actually becoming a football kit designer, because as I'm sure most of your listeners will agree, that's the likelihood of actually achieving that goal is pretty low.
Yeah. So the, when you were doing this HND course, what does it actually entail? I take it there's a mix of theory and practical work. What were the projects that you were involved in?
This was a long time ago. a lot of it would be about there would be different approaches again from a designer's point of view. So in the same way as you learn things at school like maths and English and stuff like that, there's so many different facets to design and apparel design. As I say, that can be anything from designing for the high street, where you've got to bear in mind, you know, consumers, you know, the cost of things and being able to make a profit from garments, as well as, you know, following trends and stuff like that, to couture design, which is much more about art form and actually being able to create a focus on the brand from people who've got people basically have got a lot of money, and being able to promote that brand out to smaller, what they call diffusion brands. So in other words, the only way that Gucci and Prada and these sorts of brands are able to exist is because, you know, they have these you know, they have perfumes and they have lots of ranges which are actually in the shops, but that's driven by what is on the catwalk.
Okay, so diffusion brands, are we talking, as an example, like Giorgio Armani and then Emporio Armani or Armani Jeans? Is that the same
relationship? That's exactly it, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so a lot of the couture items, I take it, would be... That's catwalk-based, I suppose, but then it's maybe given to celebrities, so there's no real profit in that, but it elevates the standard of the brand. Would that be right?
Yeah, it's all about brand promotion. But you know, as you go through, you know, university and that sort of thing, you are taught, like I said, the different facets of what it is to be a designer. So everything from, you know, designing a garment and following trends, actually bringing together a collection, to creating tech packs, which we send to factories. I'll probably come on to that a bit later. But and then actually making the garment yourself in a sewing room. With technicians and so on and so forth. So there's a huge amount of that actually goes into, you know, learning the craft of design.
Yeah. So I know you're probably going to have to rack your brains now, but do you remember there being any specific sportswear projects while you were doing the HND course? And then, so you did go on to complete a full degree in the end, was it? A full three-year course, was it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Nothing that was specifically sportswear focused, no.
Right. Okay.
But I chose to do, I mean, you can do sportswear degree courses, but because, you know, I'd had countless conversations with my tutor who was kind of like, look, try not to, pigeonhole yourself too much at this point in your career. Try and, you know, give yourself as broad a spectrum as you can, because you never know, you may not always want to be a football kit designer. And at, you know, at that point I was kind of like, well, at the very least I want to be a designer, so if I don't make it within sportswear, I'd like to do something maybe high street based or whatever that may be. So I chose a university that didn't necessarily specialize in anything, but was obviously, you know, quite focused on fashion.
Yeah. So did you feel at the time that the interest in sportswear was actually going a little bit, or was it still burning for you then at that point?
It was always still burning. I mean, I can't deny that. I mean, but it's like I said, you know, I wanted to make sure that I had the best possible chance of getting a job. And I knew even then that, you know, being able to find a job at the end of this education was going to be, you know, probably the biggest challenge. So, as I say, I wanted to give myself the best possible opportunity to do that. I remember having a conversation with my granddad, I think when I was about 10, who, you know, I'd been doing these football kits, you know, every summer for 2 or 3 years. And he said to me, he finally said, you know, one day, "What are you doing?" And I said, I showed him. And I said, "This is what I'm going to do for a job one day." And he laughed and he said, "You don't want to do something like that. There's no money in it. You should get a proper job." So from that point onwards, the more people that said it, the more people that said, you know, you're not going to be able to do that, the more it drove me to want to get there. But as I say, in order to get there, I wanted to give myself the best possible chance. So that was obviously making sure that I could diversify as much as possible before I even started out on a career.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay. So what was your... What were you... After you completed your courses, what was the... your first foray into design? So rather than education necessarily, just was there work experience, or did you find a job immediately?
I found a job immediately, but that was just again through sheer determination. It was a job that was advertised at the university, and I didn't, well, I can't remember whether I realized at the time or not, but it was, to me, it was a job. And all I cared about was getting out and working. Mm. And my, as it turns out, my first job was designing life jackets.
Hmm. Okay.
But the job that I went for was actually as an admin for a company that sold life jackets. Of course, I went for the job, and I took my portfolio down there. This time it wasn't full of football kits, which probably helped. They created a position for me because they were, again, that impressed with my burning desire and passion for what I was doing, that they actually made a job for me.
Okay, so was this an admin role within a design department of the company, or was it just general admin at the company?
No, it was an admin role within the design department.
Okay.
But as I say, it wasn't actually designing anything or whatever.
Okay.
And it was a great job. I really enjoyed it. And I was kind of in charge of what I was doing. I was actually designing extreme life jackets for people who sort of throw themselves off of 100-foot waterfalls or crash helmets on, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was for a brand called Yak,
okay,
who are owned by another company called Crewsaver. So check them out. They're still around. And it was a really good job. You know, there was a lot of technical content to this, and that's what's normally, yeah, that's what's generally motivated me as a designer. I think fashion for me is a little bit too, and I'm sure fashion designers won't thank me for saying this, but I find it too easy. I think it's easy to design a shirt with some with some frills on it and some buttons. But when you're actually, you know, the thing that really makes me tick about design is actually when you design something specifically for a purpose. And again, this was my first real drive towards actually making something which I felt really served what it was meant for. And the sort of challenges that I was facing were, you know, making it as strong and robust as possible, because obviously this was going to take in, you know, take a lot of battering from the elements.
Yeah.
But also, you know, looking at crafting the jacket so that it was it would sit as close to the body as possible. So one of the things that I was doing was just shaving sort of little parts of the foam off the actual buoyancy aid, which is, you know, like the flotation device,
yeah,
whatever, that keep people afloat. Just shaving edges off of that to make it, again, fit closer to the body and hug the person. so that they wouldn't have, you know, so we'd taken off little bits of anything that would kind of get in their way when they were paddling. Again, using neoprene on the top part instead of straps and stuff like that, just to, you know, taking those little, just obsessing the details so that it makes it that little bit better each time.
Yeah, I, from what you say there, that sounds like, obviously there'd be huge amounts of information that you would have learned over a 3-year period, but going into something so specific as that, there must have been so much research involved, so much learning of completely new materials too. Would that be the case?
Yeah, absolutely. But you kind of learn on the job. And there's people there to help you as well. You know, I wasn't starting from scratch. I was, you know, I was making things, you know, I was refining things, making them better. But it's still, you know, even to this day, it's still something that I'm quite proud of. You know, just, yeah, what was it, the sort of, like you said, the great deal of research that was involved and actually learning as you go. Was a really good learning curve.
Yeah, I, for something like that, I might be wrong, but I would assume for something like that, it is kind of life and death situations, isn't it? So that you're talking about British standards or European standards, I suppose, for safety as well. So it sounds to me like a baptism of fire of the, I'm not creating something just to look pretty, although that's an element of it as well, but it's got to suit its purpose perfectly, otherwise people could be in serious trouble. Would that be right?
Well, this is it. I mean, this is why I like sportswear so much, because, you know, there are two facets to it. One is to, as I say, design to purpose, but the second thing is to make things look cool. As far as, you know, keeping people alive is concerned, yeah, that was a major factor. But specifically testing it to those means, you know, you'd have a device that would allow you to do that. And it was quite cool, actually. It was, you have to actually measure the resistance of the foam against the water. So each buoyancy aid will have a different level of resistance depending on what you're selling it to. How you measure that is quite simple. You just cut a piece of foam, you put it into a cage, and then you drop it out down into water. And there's, you know, literally, you know, it's like a scale on the, you know, attached to it that tells you how much pressure is being resisted. So you'd kind of, you know, at the time, my challenge was obviously to take as much of that foam out of the existing buoyancy aid as possible to make it as streamlined as possible without losing that resistance.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was quite a challenge.
Yeah, it sounds particularly mathematical as well, which is not necessarily something that would jump out at you when someone says they're a designer, for example. But your role there was like hands on everything, really.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it was a small company though, so I mean, you know, it depends on what sort of company you work for. I've worked for big companies, small companies, and often you'll have it. You know, in a big company, you'll have everything from a designer to a developer to a sourcing expert to a colorist even.
But
in a company like that, that's pretty small in comparison to, say, Nike or Canterbury. You'd have somebody doing everything, which is great. You know, as a designer, you know, it's nice to be hands-on with the product.
Okay. So was Nike your next move?
No, Debenhams. That was my next move. Again, going back to the story, I was desperate not to pigeonhole myself. I was listening to advice from people, and although my first job was within sportswear, I think that was more luck than anything else, and I wanted to try and get myself out of again, make, you know, pigeonholing myself as a sportswear designer too early on in my career, because as luck would have it, when I left Crew Saver, I got offered a job at Debenhams and at Puma. And I chose to take the job at Debenhams because I wanted, you know, again, as to get away from the sportswear thing, because I knew that at some point in my career I could go back to it. And I think deep down I always knew that there would be a, you know, eventually I would.
Yeah.
Again, as I say, at the time, you know, I thought, fashion's easy, sportswear's a lot harder. But I wanted to see if that was the case. So, you know, I didn't want to kind of do people down if that if they were if it wasn't as easy as that. And so I went to Debenhams. I was working on all sorts of different brands in house there. So that was everything from Jasper Comran to John Rusher to Maine New England, all sorts of different, you know, kind of lifestyle brands as well as designer brands. And I knew that they would have the scope for me to be able to do that and to be able to sort of see what, you know, whether it was worth me moving in that direction. Okay. And in the end, I ended up spending 4 years there.
And so what did you have that question answered, or was it as easy as you thought it would be or not?
So I think the first 2 to 3 years, I mean, I was at the bottom anyway. So I was doing, although I was a designer at a small company, I ended up being I think I was a design assistant when I first went to Debenhams, doing, you know, all the different brands, just, you know, and I didn't do a great deal of designing, if I'm honest. Mm. But I worked my way through there, and I ended up, again, as luck would have it, starting a surf brand for them called Manta Ray.
Right.
I was part of the team that started that, where we sort of identified a gap in the market for the sort of fat face / white stuff kind of look.
Yeah.
At the time, there wasn't very much of that around. And we wanted to cut, you know, we noticed a lot of these sort of pockets of a cult following for these small, Fat Face was quite a small brand at the time. They didn't have that many stores. And we knew that something like that would work really well on the high street. So we took that look, and as I say, brought it to the high street and launched a sort of surf lifestyle brand.
Okay.
And it was actually that got me noticed at Nike.
Okay. So did any of the my focus is going to be on that, but did any of the performance technology creep into that, or was it still entirely lifestyle based but with a sort of surfer theme to it?
It was entirely lifestyle based with a surf theme to it.
Okay. With your background, did you find that frustrating?
I wouldn't say frustrating. As I say, I was still kind of in that zone where I wanted to branch out, see what I could do, what my limitations were. And as I say, that's why I kind of went down that route.
Okay. So, but then Nike came calling.
Yeah. It was funny. I was at a trade show in Barcelona working on Manta Ray. And I was just approached by a recruiter at Nike before I went. They said, you know, are you going to be at Bread and Butter in Barcelona? And I said yes. Funnily enough, I'd actually had an interview with them a few years previous, and it didn't go very well.
Okay.
But it was my wife that convinced me to talk to them. They sort of said they had this, that, you know, they actually had a few openings there, and would I be interested in coming over for an interview? Again, I said no, and again my wife said, well, maybe you should listen to what they've got to say, because I'm sure some of my Nike colleagues are going to listen to this thinking, what? But yeah, that's generally how it went down. I went and... I suppose the rest is history, really.
So where was this? This is the Netherlands, was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you got in there. So what was your initial role at Nike? What year are we talking now as well?
2007.
Okay. Right.
My initial role at Nike was, you know, all the time I was at Nike, I was a designer. I wasn't a senior or anything like that. I was just a regular designer. But when I first started at Nike, there was three of us who were designing everything. And that was everything from all the club kits to all the national teams as well.
So how would that work then? You say design. Can you give us some details of what that actually would entail? Because I take it would be as hands-on on as many areas as it was when you were designing life jackets. But what would be your responsibilities now when you from when you started, and then how did that progress?
So when I was first there, there was a huge. I wouldn't say that there was lots and lots of research, because you had to cover so many clubs and federations that it was impossible to go into huge amounts of depth. Mm. So, you know, a lot of the focus would obviously be on the big teams. You generally take two or three per season, and you'd sort of really focus on those because they were the biggest assets. And it would be the usual suspects, as you can imagine, like Barcelona, and at the time Juve, Inter. And, you know, there would be a fair amount of research done on those clubs or federations to establish a story or a theme for the season. But you'd also get help from the guys in country as well. And that would essentially be the kickoff process. And I have to say, you know, when I first started there, there was nowhere near the same emphasis as there is now. And I mean, personally, I was quite surprised at how little went into the process at the time. Because you really are dealing with a multitude of different people, and you have to become a bit of a politician in a way, because you're having to please, you know, your manager, the brand and the club, not to mention, you know, untold amount of others, including, well, more importantly, most importantly, are the fans. So, you know, for something that is quite, you know, it is so important, there wasn't so much focus on actually, you know, that justification of design.
Right.
For example, one of the first kits I ever did was for Barcelona, which was in 2000 and... I think it was 2009 it was launched.
Okay, yep, I remember that one, yeah. Ibrahimovic.
Yeah, that's probably most famous for, I suppose.
Yeah.
That kit was generally... The general background behind that was that we had a... our kind of story for the season across everything was menswear. Nike wanted this to come across as a refined, sharp, brand that was taking a lot of, well, some influence from tailoring.
Yeah.
So we'd take that as the overall brand story for the season, and then we'd mix that with what the country, you know, the guys in country in Spain felt was a good story for the season. And that particular story for that season was a 2005, European Cup win kit. Yeah. So, you know, the narrower stripes, which Ronaldinho wore. And that was it. You know, there was a few details that were added, you know, a little yellow pinstripe on the collar, and stuff like that. That was essentially it.
I remember that. I remember that kit, and I remember liking it. I'll probably agree with what you said, that it was a nice shirt, and it was a nice shirt and kit, and there wasn't the depth that you look at it and say that's necessarily going to be iconic to be tied to Barcelona. It was a good kit, but it was almost as if it was a great shirt done in Barcelona's colours. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Yeah, I agree.
So that would be the dearth of research involved, do you think?
Yeah, because, I mean, the team was that small. I mean, you know, don't forget Nike had only been kind of... within football, what are we talking? I mean, I suppose they only really driven into it for about 5 to 10 years before that. I think that at the time they were still finding their feet a little bit. And then, like I say, there wasn't such emphasis on the actual stories of the clubs.
Yeah.
And to be honest, like... You know, when you looked at Adidas at the time, they were also doing the same thing. And to be honest, I still think they did a similar thing now. There's the odd one that kind of pops up, but it generally is a kind of cookie cutter template that's put across most kits.
Yeah.
And it was only really, I would say, 2 to 3 years after that, that we actually hit upon the fact that, you know, fans really do start to buy into stories more when you really put that depth of research in.
Yeah. So Nike, from what I know, there was a little bit of involvement in NASL in Canada and the USA. And then Sunderland had Nike kits in the late 80s, I think. But that was more, it was probably a license thing or something. It wasn't, you wouldn't really call it them really getting involved in the football kit market. And then Arsenal were the big thing in the 90s. But that was massively, we've come in and we're making a statement and we're not going to research things at all because they went against tradition a long way. Was, from what you learnt when you came in, were there sort of red flag events like you can't do this because the traditions are such, or would it be go out and produce a good kit, and would it be an afterthought? Would you then speak to the club and they would reject it, or would you have a starting point of these are the rules that are set out by the club that you can't go too far away from?
I wouldn't say that there was a set of rules. I think we were guided by the people who were in country, and they would tell us what we shouldn't and shouldn't do. You know, they're I suppose the aficionados. They're the guys that are closest to the ground. So, I mean, you know, we're not stupid. We know that we can't do a white away kit for Barcelona, for example. Hmm. And we know that we're not going to put any white on their shirt whatsoever. You know, there's been one exception, but we wouldn't put Arsenal in a white away kit, for example. But at the same time, you're still looking for that one moment of disruption, that one kit that's going to really shake things up and make people kind of take a second look at things, you know?
Hmm. Yeah, you mentioned white away kits. I've just looked at the copper range for Barcelona. They do the official retro range for them now. And I was looking through it to see if I could find the white away kit that they wore in the 70s, but they're not selling it, so I'm going to be emailing them later because that's the one I want. What you say about, you say it's sort of common sense. You're not, obviously you're not going to be stupid to get in there in the first place, but there may be people who find themselves in a football design role where they've previously been in other sports. Their background means they're more inclined towards other sports. So I suppose there's the potential of getting tripped up by something like that if you don't have things set in place. What do you mean regarding people being in country? What does that phrase mean?
So we generally have representatives in the country. So there'll be people who work for Nike Spain, Nike France, Nike Germany, and those guys will be the people that actually liaise with the club. So as a designer, you don't actually go out to present those designs to the club yourself. And they will always also be a sounding board or a safety net between you and the club. So they will make sure that you don't go and present. Because, you know, yes, I know about Barcelona and I know not to do a white away kit for them. But I don't necessarily know as much about Fenerbahce, for example. Fenerbahce, Ferencvaros, for example.
Yeah.
And so they'll give you the necessary guidance in what you need to be able to produce a kit for them. And that's obviously invaluable to you as a designer because you don't necessarily know the culture. I use Ferencvaros as an example because they were a Nike sponsored team at the time, and to be quite honest, I don't know a great deal about I don't know in depth Hungarian football. So it's really important for them to tell you their, you know, give you their knowledge and help you to design a kit that's best for that club, and even tap into stories, anniversaries, those kind of things.
Okay, so you will have a theme to the kits, and that's probably something that you mentioned has developed since you started there and during your time there, and now maybe gone beyond that. In terms of the specifics, would you say that what you were doing as a designer was very graphics based rather than the performance element, or would that be more the developer? Where would the balance be for that?
So from, I mentioned to begin with, that at the start of, you know, when I first joined Nike, there was three of us.
Yeah.
We would have, you know, a more senior designer who would oversee everything. And then we would have myself, who was an apparel designer. And then we'd also have another guy who would do the graphics. So I would concentrate on, you know, how a garment would look, you know, what sort of collar we'd use, the fabrics you'd use, how we would finish it and construct the garment. And then the graphic designer would be the person who actually, you know, puts the print onto it or does the crest and you know, any little kind of inscription details, labels, those kind of things.
Okay. So, but you were the apparel designer, so you had a bigger hold of the finished product, I suppose. So is that in stages then? Does it start with the graphic designer? Does it move across, or how does it work?
So you work together to construct a story.
Okay.
And, you know, I can't emphasize how important it is to have a story. You know, we had a story for every single club that we did, even, you know, in the early days. You know, everyone from Barcelona to you know, Austria-Wien used to have a story. And once you constructed that story, you'd both kind of work together. Well, I suppose in the early days, you'd kind of move apart a little bit, and I would concentrate more on how we thought a collar should look, and then the graphic designer would think about any prints or stripes or whatever that may have to go onto the garment as well. So, and then you kind of come back together and discuss ideas and go from there. But yeah, it is very much a collaborative effort. Mm. Because, you know, just because you're a graphic designer doesn't mean to say that you wouldn't have a great idea for a collar, and vice versa, you know?
Okay, all right, that's good. So you mentioned earlier that it's not a conflict, it's two things being intertwined, which is performance versus style and what things will look like. You mentioned the story, and you obviously, you know, things about certain clubs, and you have people who can tell you and inform the design of kits. But will there be compromise on the saleability side in order to ensure performance, or what would be the starting point there, do you think?
I think that's a hard question to answer. I mean, you know, we used to concentrate on, you know, as I say, we'd start with a story. The story was the most important thing. Generally, the performance side of things would come from, you know, another team. We'd actually have an innovation team that would work in-house to look at how we could improve the kits, you know, the chassis of a kit every season. They would look at, you know, everything from, you know, how the fabric performs to, you know, obviously the laser cut holes that you see on kits, those kind of things. What generally is our focus in terms of innovation for the season, and that's really important for Nike as a brand. And then obviously, you know, as an apparel designer, it was my job to kind of come in with the fluff a little bit. And So you kind of already have a rough idea of where they wanted to drive the innovation first. So that was almost the first layer. And then on top of that, you would layer the story of what we feel best connects with the fans. And the real focus, as it's always been with Nike, is about connecting with the fans. I think, you know, sometimes they get a bit of a rough deal from some supporters in that people think that they just come up with any old rubbish just to kind of sell kits sometimes. Mm. And I promise you, the amount of work and research and focus really that goes into developing a kit is unbelievable.
Okay.
So yes, it's to answer your question, it's a bit of both, really. As I say, performance is obviously really important to Nike because that's what they stand for as a brand. But more importantly, it's about making sure that they connect with fans. So it's not about saleability or anything like that. It's about making sure that you've got something that actually a fan understands and really feels like they've actually you've actually got their club. You know, you understand what their club represents.
Yeah, I might be thinking in there's a, I've got a couple of questions regarding this, but I might be thinking a little bit too much from a marketing point of view. And it's interesting to know that that story is it comes from you rather than something that's been fed to you from a marketing team. Would that be right? So it's not you're not told by marketing specialists this is what we're going to do this season. Now build a shirt around that. It comes from you directly, does it?
Well, it wasn't the no. It did come from the marketing team in the first place.
Right.
When I first got there, and you know, again, as I say, we were a small team. That's how it started. You know, a marketing team would just feed us what they felt was right for the season. It was still connecting with the fans, and it was still important, but it wasn't anywhere near the emphasis that grew during the time that I was there. Because I think, you know, I should say at this point that it's really important to note that I went from a small team, you know, where there was just three of us. And as I say, we had to kind of spread ourselves pretty thin across a multitude of different clubs and federations. Right the way through, as you know, I spent 7 years there to what grew into a team of probably, I would say, 20 people in the end, focusing on probably a less amount of federations and clubs. And you'd end up working with, I would work as an apparel designer with one other graphic designer on, and we cover maybe 4 to 5 clubs a season. So I went from probably 20, more than that, to four, you know, really drilling down into 4 to 5 clubs. And with respect to teams like Dynamo Moscow, you know, that was one of my clubs. So it wasn't, you know, the focus went from, you know, me just kind of doing a, you know, a small amount of attention on our big clubs like Barcelona and Brazil to, like I say, real focus on every single Nike team.
Okay. I mean, I know that you haven't been there recently, so the latest ranges from Nike.
That's not to do with me, by the way.
Yeah, nothing.
I'm going to put a disclaimer right down on that one.
Well, but that's an example I'm thinking of, where it's so performance based that how much designing actually goes into that. That it looks to me like there's only a graphic designer that would have a job there once the kits need to be designed. Because everything has gone into the development and construction of the kits. So that's an extreme example, but would there not be an element of that?
So I have to be sort of careful how I tread here, but yeah, I mean, the kits that are out now are obviously, you know, they were designed after I left.
Yeah.
And I think those kits have come in for a lot of negative reaction from certain people because they all do look very similar. And I don't know what, you know, what direction Nike have decided to move in since I've gone or whatever, but I think it's really hard for me to comment on this one because
I don't want to put you into a difficult position, but you've mentioned a couple of times what sort of collar would be involved in the shirt and so on, but that's, well, there's no collars for a start on the current lot. Well, that's to be put to one side. I'm just thinking, if you are told by another department, collars weigh down the shirt too much, there's no collars anymore, that's going to have an effect on how you design a shirt?
Yeah, absolutely. But there's other areas that you can focus on. As I say, I don't really know what has gone into the new kit, so I can't really comment on that. But when I was there, as I say, the focus was on about... the innovation team would give you guide rails in terms of what they wanted to get across as far as new technology was concerned, and you work within those boundaries. So yeah, I do agree that the new kits have come in for a lot of flack, but I mean, that is surely what a kit is about, right? It's making sure that you can give the athlete that last little bit of help that's going to give them, it's going to get them over the line in winning the game.
Because
we are talking about, as any sport is concerned, we are talking about fine margins that, you know, you could talk about percentages, small, 3-4% that could actually win you a game.
Yeah, no, certainly. So I can understand that element. I wonder to what, from a marketing point of view, to have that as the starting point, because we've seen a lot of, say, black shirts. So you say that the importance is what the fans are going to be able to engage with, what's going to excite the fans. But I suppose the sales element is based on maybe they might be loosely a fan, but a person in England buying a Barcelona shirt is not necessarily a fan. They're just someone who likes the shirt. So we've seen an increase in black shirts because supposedly they look good with jeans, and it's unobtrusive, I suppose, in your life if you're wearing a black football shirt, so you can wear it with other things. But for the push towards sportswear, does that not compromise making the product look as good as it possibly can for sales first? I know sales isn't going to be your focus. You are creating a work of art and then it goes elsewhere. But is that not a problem if you're focusing on performance to that extent?
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain element of commerciality that comes into everything you design. Of course it is. Obviously, you need to design something that people are going to buy, because that's what pays you wages. But, you know, as I say, I think if you make that connection with the fans in the first place, they're going to buy the product. And I get what you're saying in terms of, you know, a guy who, you know, doesn't necessarily support Barcelona is going to come and buy the shirt just because he likes the shirt. But that's also because he, you know, he buys into Barcelona and he likes the shirt, whatever. I mean, having said that, I suppose there's also that element of, you know, when people think that, you know, whatever you do within kit design, people are going to buy it. If they're a Barcelona fan, then they're going to buy the shirt. But, you know, I mean, you'd be surprised. A Barcelona fan, I mean, you know, that's a whole another subject as well. You know, there's a different culture in buying football shirts in different countries than there is to the UK. I think, you know, we're avid football shirt buyers. You know, it's almost like it's a tradition. You buy your new shirt at the start of every season. Whereas in Spain, they don't tend to buy shirts like that. They'll buy a shirt every 3 to 4 seasons when their old one, you know, gets a bit tatty or whatever, and they need a new one. And so, you know, you really do need to make that connection with them. And I mean, I keep saying it, but you do have to get across that you understand the club. And you're trying to get a message in that shirt.
Yeah, so the message element is interesting. I know what you mean regarding people, because I see pictures of the Nou Camp and I look through all the different shirts, and it's great for me because I look through them and I can name the seasons. But I take the point that not everyone's buying the new shirt, whereas, say, for a club like, I imagine this is your experience of it, Celtic, everyone will get the new shirt at the beginning of the new season. So I remember Seville when Celtic played against Porto, and you looked at the crowd and everyone had the brand new shirt, which was a shirt that the players on the pitch had never even worn before. So we have that culture in this country, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I think I don't think it's quite as big as it was. I think people are starting to, I mean, this whole retro thing is rising. A lot more people are seeing the value in a retro shirt rather than a new shirt.
And also now you only have a shirt only lasts for a season as well. So I suppose it's a lot of money to shell out if you're going to buy the shirt each season as well. You, having been there for the time you were there, did you notice any patterns in what you did with the kit? So if you did something particularly bold, did you find that did particularly well? Did you change your approach and have classic, then a bold shirt and that kind of thing? Or are there any certain rules that you had through experience?
You did try to spike it because you can't do, you know, an amazing shirt every season, and you can't have a talked about shirt every single season. So you would try to look at, you know, I mean, this is something that came in a little while after I started, and then we start to look at a timeline of a shirt, look at, you know, where we could pull in anniversaries, where we could look, you know, bring in a certain story and so on and so forth. We'd actually plan that out. So, you know, if we could see that Barcelona were going to have an anniversary of something in, you know, 2019 or whatever, we'd make sure that the shirt leading up to that was, you know, a more of a classic, so that you could draw emphasis onto to that big spike the following year. By the same token, you don't want to have some a mental shirt followed by another mental shirt. Yeah, you want to have peaks and troughs to things. You want to see that classic element, you know, as you look back through history, to remain. You know, you want to make sure that you see them, you know, consistently going back to their classic blue and blaugrana.
Well, that's the cliche, is that what can you do with stripes? Well, I think with Barcelona, certainly over the last 10 years or so, we've seen all the different things that can be done with stripes, and there's positive and negative elements to that as well. So the argument would be that there's a loss of identity if you go too far away from that, but there is the injection of history in there. So the half and half shirt when they won the Champions League in 2009 and so on, obviously people might have problems with that, but it does nod back to the past as well. When you were what other shirts were you particularly proud of in your time there?
I think my biggest legacy will be the French shirt, and I think that was 2011. So it's the first French shirt that we did for Nike, where we, you know, did the sort of the really sharp collar, button-up collar. We took the blue right down to make it, you know, more of a dark blue. And then we did the Marinière for the away kit.
Yeah, remember them well. Now, you say in 2009 for Barcelona, there was a classic approach, and it was like menswear, and it was towards fashion a little bit. That ties in quite well with what was going on at Umbro at the time, which in effect was the same company. Was there crossover in design? Was there dialogue between the two design teams there?
No, absolutely not. A lot of people ask me this actually, because I was quite annoyed at the time. I was working on that French kit when England probably brought out what I would consider the best kit they've ever had. And I think that was for 2010 World Cup. And they had the full white kit with the collar on it. And as I say, that was, for me, is still one of the most beautiful kits that's ever been done. And I was absolutely gutted at the time because I was working on this French kit, and I was I'd actually done all the research. I, you know, basically started designing, and all, you know, I would say that kit was probably a watershed moment within, you know, my approach to design from Nike. You know, I think it's probably fair to say most, you know, the company in general, towards football kits, because we put a huge amount of detail and research into every single component of that kit. The collar was derived from a Christian Dior shirt. The colour of the kit itself was brought right down because we were looking at, you know, classic French sophistication. Even the fabric that we were using, I wanted to use a fabric that looked like polyester on the outside and behaved like polyester, but on the inside it had that luxury feel of cotton. We made the short longer because we were focused again on making the silhouette look more elongated and smarter and sharper, all sorts of things like that. And then Umbro went and brought out that kit, and it just completely stole my thunder.
Certainly the shorts, I remember Nike shorts at the time were so wide, so baggy, and then they got cut in around the time of that France kit. Would that be right? Would that be sort of stripping away extra fabric at that point? That's the way it would look to us. And I think it was the 2012 European Championship kits that seemed to be massively influenced by those Umbro England kits. Were you behind those? Were you involved in those as well?
Yeah,
the France ones.
But it wasn't.
No. Okay.
It absolutely wasn't.
No. But it fits the development of the France kit design as well. So you would imagine those kits would be coming off the first Nike France kits, but because of the time it was, and because the highest profile kit of that style earlier was that Umbro kit, you can see why people would draw that conclusion from it. But
I can see why people would make the connection. I mean, the thing was, with that France kit, we also, you know, as a brand, they wanted to set a precedent as well. It was such a multi-million dollar contract that they wanted to really draw a line in the sand, and I think they did. You know, as much as, you know, there can be sort of similarities between that and the England kit, I think in terms of general kit design, I personally think that was a watershed moment in terms of, you know, approach and general look. I mean, if you look at the timeline of kits over the years, I think those two kits will stand the test. Well, will be seen as a point at which, you know, things did change.
Yeah, I, looking at the evolution since, and the graphical things are coming back. There's a lot more embellishment on football kits again, but I quite like the way it's being done at the minute. I look back on that kit and I go, I remember how excited it was, and I remember. I mean, the same with the France kits as well, because they were a massive big deal because of what Adidas had done with their last kits. So that was very... The graphics on the France kit for the 2010 World Cup were very much based around the form, but in a performance sense. So it was about highlighting the abs and that kind of thing, rather than style or being classic or anything like that. So that was a direct contrast to what you did. But now you look at the development since, and you look back on that England kit, and you go, is it too simple? Because we're used to what's happened over the past couple of years. So I remember what it was like, and I stand by the way I felt at the time, but you can understand people now going back to the same response which we had then, which is, well, that's just a polo shirt, isn't it? And it's now you can sort of understand that a little bit more, but at the time it was like, no, this is fantastic, it's stripping away all that's terrible about football kits. So that's what it seemed like then.
Yeah, I think, I think things have gone again too far in the embellishment direction. I'd like to see, you know, I'm a bit of a purist when it comes to kits. I think it's that constant struggle between, you know, purity and making something new, making something look new and fresh and unique, that, you know, that is what it is to be a designer all the time. You know, you're constantly having these fights with yourself about being able to get the best you possibly can out of a kit. And I think, you know, for me, that England kit stands out because it is so pure. And it was, you know, I think there's a Japanese philosophy of, I can't remember exactly what it's called, but it's the idea behind it is that you have one design detail in something, and you believe in that detail so much that you only need that, and you stand by it, and you be brave and bold, and you don't need all the other stuff around it. I think if you have one great story and one great element to a kit, you don't need anything else. You know, one of the kits that always stands out for me was a Nike kit that a colleague of mine did. That was Juve away 2012 maybe, and it was pink with just a massive black star on it.
Oh yeah.
And the fact that it was so bold, you know, it was bright pink, but and it had a great big black star in it. I just thought it was super cool. And it's having, you know, it's being brave enough to sort of say, you know, that's it. That is, it only needs that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was a great shirt. And I agree with what you say. A lot of the Adidas kits recently, and I love Adidas, but they seem to have too many elements. There was a Scotland kit that had tartan as well as other things going on, and it just seems that there's a little bit of overkill going on with a lot of kits today. But I'm hoping that things are improving a little bit, and they seem to be. You moved on from Nike. Where did you move on to?
I went to Canterbury, the rugby brand.
So it was direct to Canterbury. And what was your role there?
I was off-field designer. So that meant that I did everything that is used off-pitch. So that's everything from what the fans wear to the games, to their other range of kind of leisure wear as well that's kind of stocked in JD, JJB, those kind of stores.
Okay, so just as an example, that I know that Canterbury for their rugby shirts at the minute have a player version, and then there's an old style rugby version, old rugby shirt. What you would describe as a rugby shirt version that they have for fans. Would that be something you'd be involved with, or would that still be the sportswear side, the performance side of it?
No, I would do that. I would do the old style shirts for fans. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, how did you find that? Was that a culture clash based on your experience at Nike?
Well, for as much as I've told you that, you know, I was desperate to get into kits, I really wanted to do kits. I think in the end, 7 years at Nike doing that job was quite a long time, and I needed something to kind of, you know, I needed to have a bit of a change. I still wanted to design sportswear, but I wanted to do something a little bit different. And obviously, you know, I'm, as well as a football fan, I mean, I'm a general sports fan, but rugby's probably my second sport, and it seemed like a natural progression.
Okay. So you worked there for how long? How long were you at Canterbury for?
I was only there for 12 months.
12 months, okay. So was that, what was your experience there? Was it, is it something, is that shift away from the on-field sportswear to the more leisure-based area, was that the right move again? Because I suppose that has parallels with Debenhams again, doesn't it? Is it going back to that kind of thing?
Well, quite honestly, the reason was more for personal reasons than anything else.
Oh, right, okay.
As far as actually working on the product was concerned, it was, you know, it was a really good experience. The actual product itself, yes, was more influenced by fashion, but there was also a heavy sportswear influence as well, because, you know, you're talking about a very historical brand that's been around for over 100 years. So the plethora of archive and history and authenticity that has to go into their product is huge. And I, you know, as well as working on, you know, sort of tracksuits and hoodies and stuff like that, I also managed another area which was called 1904, and is a much more kind of high end product that's sort of stocked in House of Fraser and Harvey Nicks and places like that. So there's that element of real traditional sport that's brought into leisure wear. As well as that, you know, there's, as I say, the influence of, you know, working on, there's also the facet of working on sportswear and general hoodies and tracksuit bottoms and stuff like that.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, of course. Do you find, obviously you're aiming again at sports fans, particularly for a lot of the off-field rugby wear. So what are we talking, British Lions here? And so you worked on the British Lions stuff that's just come out, is that right?
I did, the first range that came out for them. So I did it was like a limited edition shirt that was, I think they did 1,957 of them, which was the year that Canterbury actually first made the shirt for the Lions. Uh-huh. And that was to launch the, you know, to celebrate the them taking over as the main sponsor. And that was a shirt that, as I say, was a shirt that was first made for the Lions by Canterbury inadvertently. Basically what happened was that the Lions went over to New Zealand to do a tour, and ended up, the shirts all got ripped and destroyed in one particular game. So a local company supplied those shirts, which was Canterbury.
It was Canterbury.
So we redid that shirt to celebrate that famous collaboration.
Now, you talk about the story involved in producing a football kit for the fans, for the club. Now, Canterbury have England and they have the Lions now as well. Do you find that there are extra pressures in rugby compared to football? Are rugby fans more discerning, or is the public more discerning in that element?
Well, that's hard to say because obviously, you know, I worked on kits at Nike and an off-field product at Canterbury. But in terms of an overall customer, I think they're quite similar. I think, you know, they, both fans do appreciate, you know, the effort when they see a story actually come to fruition in a shirt. If they can understand, you know, that there is a story and there is part of the club's heritage within that shirt, you know, they do. They do appreciate it. And I know, you know, at Canterbury, having worked with the guys who do the on-field product, there is a huge amount of research and storytelling that goes into their kits as well.
Okay. Now, we've been talking for a long time, so I'm just interested in what's going on with you now. What are you involved in now? Is it your freelance sportswear designer? Is that right?
I am. I also, you know, I work on a lot of workwear product.
Okay.
For certain brands. I've also worked for Franklin and Marshall.
Okay.
Yeah, they're a sort of heritage sportswear brand. Who else? A brand called Rampant Sporting, who are also a very English heritage brand. All sorts.
Yeah. So do you see the industry is going in that direction? I say this because I spoke to Jason Lee on this podcast, and he was at Adidas for a long time, and Harmore as well. And he's now a freelance designer. Is that a natural progression for a designer, or is that indicative of the industry that more freelance people will be involved now?
I don't know. Part of me does think that... more companies, but you know, because of the times that we live in, you know, people want to be sort of looser in their approach, you know, in how they work, when they work. But I also think companies are more flexible in how they work as well. You know, they're fine. I think companies are finding that it's easier to bring designers in for a small period of time to see if something works. And if it does, you know, they'll keep producing it. But if it doesn't, it's I know this sounds pretty cynical, but it's easier to get rid of people if something's not working.
Yeah. Oh, certainly. I speak as a self-employed person who knows that all too well. How do you think this is going to impact on design? Do you see just positives in that, or do you think that there's the potential for the lineage of, say, a football kit from 5 years ago and that progression to today, will it seem more disjointed if different people are working on it each season?
I don't think so. So long as you've got a consistency there in terms of who's managing the operation. And, you know, you generally tend to get that with brands like Nike. You know, they've had a consistency in their approach to design over the years. I would say there's probably a lot of different people who've worked on the product that they've produced over the last 20 years, and you generally see a consistency there. And I think, you know, to have different people working on different products, it really does bring a fresh approach to things. It's really important to have new ideas and a new focus. Okay. And quite honestly, that's probably, you know, one of the big factors in why I left Nike in the end, because as much as I still have a burning desire to, you know, I'm a football kit anorak. I still love football kits, and I get really excited, you know, when the summer comes, because that's one of the things I look forward to most. But I knew that, you know, I had to kind of move on myself as a designer to keep that fire burning and keep myself fresh.
Mm. Do you see potential for you to be working on football kits again in the future?
I hope so. I'd like to do it more from a freelance perspective now, and, you know, maybe have, you know, maybe do one or two in the future, perhaps. I'd like to work on a grassroots brand. Yeah. you know, somebody who's just starting out perhaps, and you know, looking to kind of bring fresh and new ideas into kits. I think a lot of, you know, smaller brands tend to follow Nike and Adi, and kind of do versions of what they're doing. I'd like to see someone start up something which, you know, has a slightly new approach to it and actually does have a connection to grassroots football rather than just another template.
Yeah.
But I like being freelance, and I like being able to work across a multitude of different things. And so, you know, not doing football kits at this point in time is top of my agenda. But I am hoping to write something very soon. I won't go into too much detail on that because none of the contracts have been signed yet. But okay. Hopefully, you should see some. You should see a book or two from me in the future.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Well, good luck with that and all of the designing. Is there any way we could get hold of you on Twitter, anything like that?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I think it's just Sean Pankhurst on okay. Twitter.
Ideal. So if there's anything further that people want to know, then they can give you a shout. Well, thanks very much for that, Sean. That's been fantastic. As I say, I wish you luck for the future. Thank you for being so candid. It's been a pleasure having you on, and hopefully I'll speak to you soon.
Perfect.
Yeah, so thank you to Sean, and I'm J29ers on Twitter if anyone wants to get hold of me. Make sure to visit the site and Design Football on Twitter and designfootball.com on Facebook. So get in touch with us if there's anything you'd like to know. We'll be back soon with another podcast. And a new guest. Thanks very much for listening. Bye bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.